Welcome to another episode of Disrupt. I'm Home Healthcare News Editor Andrew Downman. Today, we're diving into the legal trends that home health and hospice agencies should be paying attention to in 2023. We're joined by Matt Wolf, a shareholder at the law firm Baker Donaldson. But first, a word from Homecare Homebase. Homecare Homebase helps our customers take the guesswork out of home-based care by providing the technology, services, and analytics required to care for patients across the nation. HCHB is more than just an EHR. We provide solutions to the problems that keep providers up at night and help them get back to focusing on exceptional care. Organizations seeking to save time and money with a more centralized approach to agency administration need HCHB. Visit HCHB.com to learn more. In today's episode, we're going to be chatting with Wolf, whose clientele includes a wide variety of healthcare providers, including home health and hospice agencies. We dive into the legal trends that will define the next year, both good and bad. Okay, Matt, so let's just start. Before we get going in the conversation, I would like for you to give a background on yourself. Obviously, we know each other well, but for the audience that may not know you, on kind of the work you do before we get going here.
Yeah, absolutely, Andrew, and it's a pleasure to talk with you today. Matt Wolf, I am an attorney with the law firm Baker Donaldson, and I represent healthcare providers across the continuum of care, and that includes home health, home care, and hospice providers. And what I do for them varies on the day and sometimes the hour, but my job is primarily to counsel them on regulatory and legal issues and to try to address compliance issues proactively and also represent them before various courts and administrative bodies.
Okay, fantastic. And then also, we'd love to jump into something that you and I talked about recently, which is somewhat topical. There's a case in Kentucky. Basically, these two potential owners of a home health agency in the Louisville area, they wanted to open up a home health agency specifically tailored to the Nepali-speaking people in that Louisville area. They were denied a certificate of need, and they tried to eventually take it up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court is not going to be hearing that case, but you and I sort of talked about certificate of need and the arguments there. And I just want to get your thoughts again on that case for the podcast listeners here.
Yeah, happy to do so. So it's a case that is really a part of a broader movement by many anti-CON advocates to try to find a court that will determine that certificate of need law, which varies from state to state, is unconstitutional, either under the state constitution or, in the case in Kentucky, under the federal constitution. Those cases take a variety of form, and they've challenged a variety of different aspects of the certificate of need law. In this case, it was Kentucky's requirement that prior to being able to operate a home health agency, a would-be operator had to acquire a certificate of need law. And the courts, as have been pretty much the case across the board, determined that Kentucky's certificate of need law was constitutional and therefore dismissed the plaintiff's claims.
I really think it's interesting. You know, obviously, certificate of need exists in more than just home health care, but I do think it's interesting, Matt, just because there's obviously a ton of anti-CON people in the industry, and there's also a ton of pro-CON people in the industry. And I think the pros and the cons of each are very compelling. I found myself swayed by both arguments before. I assume a lot of people feel that way, and that sometimes people feel that's anti-competition to have those CON laws, but also in these kinds of industries, it's obviously very important to maintain quality and some sort of oversight, and having CON laws allows for that. I just want to know, what do you think is going to take place over the next 10 years here with these two combative sides? Obviously, you said originally that the courts have generally ruled on the side of CONs being constitutional, but do you think there's going to be any change with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that, you know, it's a very hotly debated issue, and it's one that's going to continue to be debated over the coming years. Frankly, I think it's a debate that's better to be had in policy circles and with state legislatures and with state executive agencies, and not really an appropriate conversation to be had, at least on a policy level, in our courts. I think it's hard to predict what's going to happen, and obviously so much of this is going to depend on the particular state that we're talking about, because remember, CON laws don't exist in all states. And even in those states that do have CON laws, not all include home health and not all include a hospice, including hospice residential or inpatient or even hospice at home. And even in those states that do regulate hospice and home health through certificate of need law, their processes vary greatly. What they all have in common is that there's some type of methodology or approach to determining whether there is sufficient need in the communities to support, for example, a new home health agency. The way in which that methodology is developed and then the way that the methodology is applied varies greatly from state to state. And it also can vary from year to year in those states. And so what I always encourage people to do that, you know, may have that sort of reactive aversion to CON laws is to actually better understand the process and determine how someone can participate in it. So, you know, for example, in a state in which I work, there was a not all that different application than what was described in the Kentucky litigation by a group of individuals who felt like another language minority was underserved. And in that situation, that would-be operator was actually able to obtain a certificate of need by going through the legislative process as opposed to going to a court and saying, we don't want to have to comply with this requirement. So I think there are avenues for those who are on the outside looking in to be able to obtain CONs. Obviously, many new entrants in the markets in states that have CONs do so via acquisition. But there's a whole host of other options that are out there to be able to do so. I personally think that certificate of need laws are helpful and are important for ensuring that we have home health agencies that are of a sufficient size and take care of a sufficient census of patients so that they can meet the rigorous Medicare conditions of participation and can provide quality care. I think that's really important for the industry as it matures and as it evolves. And frankly, as patients, payers, and other providers in the system continue to demand more and more from home health providers.
Yeah, I think that's well said. And we can move on from that. I just thought it was interesting, especially because it was a pretty big news story in home health specific. But I want to move on to, I think it's a good time of year, obviously, with 2022 coming to a close, just to sort of look across the industry, Matt, and think about what are some of the biggest legal concerns for providers now. Some of them are pretty constant, and then some of them are changing frequently. So I just want to get your perspective as an expert on what you're most dealing with, what you're most considering with your clients right now as we near December here.
Yeah, sure. I think we are really at a pivotal stage in the industry. We are slowly and not so surely emerging from the pandemic, although we still are technically under the federal public health emergency and anticipate doing so at least into 2023. But COVID exposed the significant need for home-based care and a significant challenge in the current environment for providing it. And those concerns include the staffing crisis that providers continue to face, includes some of the built-in payment challenges and the reliance to a large extent by home health agencies on Medicare fee-for-service. And it also includes certainly a growing adaptation of technology into home health, but there's obviously still a lot more opportunity to do so. So as I sort of look ahead to 2023 and think about, you know, the most pressing legal or regulatory concerns for home health providers, I would say staffing, staffing retention and staffing engagement, the adoption of technology and incorporation into operations, payor engagement, and that, you know, that doesn't just mean Medicare fee-for-service and Medicaid or fee-for-service or Medicaid managed care, but it also includes Medicare Advantage. Obviously, your publication has done a lot of great reporting recently on larger home health organizations that have been able to contract with large MA plans, and I think that trend is going to continue. And then finally, and this I may sound like a broken record about this, but compliance. The fact that home health agencies, along with lots of other healthcare providers, were lauded as heroes in the early days of the pandemic, may give some the false comfort that there aren't auditors and surveyors and investigators that are looking closely and scrutinizing the growing role of home health in our healthcare ecosystem. And so I think providers that are looking to not just survive, but to thrive in the post-COVID world are going to need to invest significantly in ensuring their compliance programs aren't just updated, but that they're fully implemented and that they become part of the fabric and culture of the organization.
Okay, great. So we can kind of touch on a few of those, but I think that we'll start with compliance, which is the last one you mentioned, Matt. So in terms of compliance, I think it's also interesting, as you put it, the spotlight has really benefited home-based care providers, whether that's personal care, home health. But at the same time, that means there might be more scrutiny than usual. But also something to consider, I think, is, as you said, you have to invest in this compliance. And I think that if there's organizations who see this opportunity to grow, that's probably something that they may not consider as much as they should, which is, hey, we want to grow. We want to invest in resources to grow, but also we need to invest in, you know, compliance so that once we do have a bigger footprint and we're recognized as a larger provider, we're not at risk of not being in compliance.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And that's something I see and is frankly common, not just amongst home health providers, but across really any type of healthcare provider, where a provider experiences significant growth through operating in the right way and investing in their workers and in developing their knowledge and expertise. And oftentimes the compliance programs, and not just the programs themselves, but the staffing and other resources needed to support them, do not keep pace. So making sure that as an organization grows, that you're also making sure that the compliance program that organization grows with the organization. And that requires conducting a review of its effectiveness, looking at what additional resources needed to be provided to it, and what new risks providers face in our evolving regulatory environment.
Okay. And in terms of staffing, what specifically, Matt, do you tell providers to look after in terms of the staff, the different staffing legal hot waters that they can get into?
Yeah, well, we could take an entire podcast episode on that question alone. Obviously, just sort of, you know, to hit a few highlights, you have Wage and Hour Act concerns, you have issues with ensuring that you're paying for travel time, you know, mileage reimbursement, obviously making sure that you have an environment that is diverse and inclusive and non-discriminatory. And, you know, I think that as providers continue to struggle with hiring and retaining sufficient staff to be able to actually take all the referrals that they have, investing in what it takes in order to retain staff is going to be increasingly important. And obviously there's not one size fit all solution to doing that. That requires investments in what I like to think of as sort of career paths and career trajectories for individuals who are involved in home-based care. Because ultimately, I don't know that you're ever going to be able to provide, you know, a sufficient hourly wage for direct care workers to be able to keep up with restaurants and large technology companies that are coming in and offering, you know, really, really high wages. What I think that healthcare providers can do is to say, this is not just a way to make, you know, ends meet for the next few months, but this is really a way to have a career in healthcare. It's a great entry point to having a career in healthcare that can be sustainable and that can be meaningful.
Okay. And then something else that I've been thinking about, is because some of these companies obviously need more staff than they're able to hire at times, and sometimes they're using part-time workers or workers from staffing agencies when there's people out sick, like what happened in early January during the Omicron surge. Does that also come with legal risks when you have non-full-time workers working for you more often than usual?
Sure. I think every organization, every employer has to consider not just where it gets its staff from, but what the right sort of mix or ratio is of part-time versus full-time, directly employed versus through staffing agencies. Again, I'm not in the business of telling providers how to run their companies, but I do think when you're relying primarily or even exclusively upon staffing agencies, you lose the ability to control or influence the quality of care, health outcomes, which are going to be so critical for providers as they move along the value-based continuum and as they diversify their payers and they meet some of the new value-based purchasing obligations under the home health final rule.
Okay. And then technology, Matt, you mentioned that, and I was sort of interested that you did or intrigued. What's the case with technology in terms of legality and making sure that your agency runs smoothly? What are some things to consider there?
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of promise, obviously, in technology and you know, being able to better serve the patient and provide additional data that providers can rely upon in order to be able to shape and refine the plan of care. There's also an incredible amount of data that can be used to help evolve how we pay for and how we provide care moving forward. And I think home-based care providers are uniquely positioned to be able to tap in to that data just simply because of their proximity and access to patients in their daily affairs. We also have to realize that data is highly sensitive information and that home health or home-based care providers need to be very careful on how that data is transmitted from patient through their providers to or through vendors. And so I think that being very careful and thoughtful about IT contracts, making sure that vendors that providers work with are helping really to ensure better care to patients, to provide more value to payers, and to help the provider to grow. I think that you know where the uncertainty is that there was such an explosion, seemingly overnight, of so-called telehealth that most people don't want to go back to the way things were pre-March 2020. People now appreciate being able to see a doctor from the comfort of their own home, and you know, in some cases, to be able to consult with or be examined by providers. And I think that's going to continue to grow. And I think home care providers home-based care providers can play an important connecting role in that, can also provide additional information for providers that frankly may still have concerns about the utilization of telehealth and sort of losing that connectivity to a patient that may no longer be in their exam room.
And I think what you mentioned with the data sharing, Matt, I assume that applies to payers too, what you were talking about earlier, right? Just because sometimes when home-based care providers come together with a payer and they might have an innovative program to work on together, whether that's value-based or risk sharing, whatever you want to call it, I assume that applies there too in terms of sharing the data.
Well, it does. And I mean, and good data, sophisticated data is what drives all of those value-based arrangements. And so if you don't feel confident about your data and you don't feel confident about the ability to harvest additional data, it's going to be very difficult to be able to play in that value-based space.
Absolutely. Okay, so moving on, not totally moving on, but if you want to whittle things down here a little bit for us, Matt, if there are two things that you believe providers should be most focused on heading into 2023, what would you say those two are?
I think we're going to continue to see, with all of the uncertainty, we're going to continue to see consolidation in the industry. And I think that if you're a small to medium-sized provider, the temptation may be to find some dance partner to be able to grow. I think there's also opportunities to grow organically and to grow across lines of service. We talked before we started recording about the number of providers that are in all of the different auspices, home health, hospice, home-based care. So I think there's, you know, the continued opportunities to grow organically. And I think there's also opportunities to be able to develop niches amongst, you know, certain specialized populations and to go deep into communities as opposed to just going big. I do think, though, that the regulatory scrutiny and the regulatory uncertainty that we're going to see, even though we now have a finalized home health rule, there's still a lot of uncertainty about how the behavioral adjustment is going to play out long term, whether Congress intervenes, whether litigation becomes necessary, and then what CMS does in the final rule for 2024. And so I think that providers that want to be able to succeed are going to continue to need to look at ways to not just do what they did before, but to be able to position themselves to be able to thrive in this ever-changing environment. If I had to sort of whittle it down to two things that providers should focus on, I would go back to what I said before, staffing and compliance.
Yep. Staffing and compliance obviously come with sort of a negative connotation in that there's threats. If we could end on a positive note, Matt, what do you think is something positive, any legal development, anything in regards to policy, something positive that home-based care providers can take home as we, again, wrap up 2022?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think there are a lot of positive things to reflect on, and you know, lawyers get a reputation, and probably deservedly so, for being somewhat negative or pessimistic. But I think there are a lot of exciting things that have happened. I think that there has been a growing recognition and embrace of the importance of home-based care as part of the continuum of healthcare. And I think home-based care providers need to take advantage of this window to assert their roles in the healthcare space with payers, with policy makers, and with other providers. So I think that's a really positive development. And I think the other positive development is the growing role of technology in home-based care. And you know, I'm hopeful that there will be sufficient revenue for home-based care providers to receive so that they can continue to make the necessary investments in technology to better serve patients.
Absolutely. Well, all right, Matt, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Andrew. Thank you for reaching out.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Disrupt. For more news and insights on the home health, home care, and hospice industries, subscribe to our daily or weekly newsletters at homehealthcarenews.com. I'm Andrew Donlin, and this has been a production of Aging Media Network, Chicago, Illinois.